Oh, not, hi.
Hello. Were we not on at that time?
You're just a little premature. That's all right, though. I'm here
sorry.
To cover for you.
I wasn't looking for the
not
lights.
No problem.
All right, so my name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And so we have another fun episode of We the People for you today. We have two guests today, two totally different topics, which is nice. So I'm going to change it up a wee bit. We have the Consul General of Israel, Mr. Shlomi Kaufman, and that ought to be tons of fun. We're going to learn all about that. I know we all know there are, you know, consulates for all these different countries here in the U.S., but what do they do?
Yeah. Who are they and what do they do?
Nobody knows.
Yeah.
So anyway, thought we would learn a little bit about that and what's going on with the 70th birthday of Israel. So that was kind of fun.
Yeah.
Got some good stuff for you on the webpage I did put. It's very long, so I just actually included the link from their Facebook page. But Israel's turning 70, and they have a post from March 15th that gives you 70 years of Israeli achievement. And it's really a nice, nice long timeline. But it isn't just little factoid things, little facts. It's got pictures. So it's really kind of interesting. I think you'd like it. And our sponsor for this hour is
Team Power.
Oh, welcome, Bill.
Team Power is our local John Deere Kubota dealer. If you need a tractor or you need tractor service, go by and see Team Power. They're at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake, just south of Phil's Propeller. And right now they are bloated at the seams with tractors. Go by and make a deal. And if they don't have it in stock, they can definitely get it for you.
Oh, come on, they have it in stock.
I'm sure they do. I drive by there and I see, you know, they can't hardly get the gate shut. There's so many tractors in that yard. So go by and see them. Team Power, phone number 226-9226.
And if you happen to be in Redding or Shasta County today and you want to look at equipment, you can scurry down to the fairgrounds.
Nope. Scurry down to the convention center. They're having home and garden show down there, and we've got a little display down there. If you want to come down and look at some tractors, we got them.
Lovely. Okay. Anything else we forgot? Website, did I say that already? I got like 3 hours of sleep. Sorry, I'm probably going to have to need some help today. You can find all of our information at wethepeopleradio.us. We always have archives up right after the show. We have commercial-free archives dating back to 2010 on every topic under the sun. So if you want to contact us, you have ideas for guests or shows or topics or whatever, get a hold of us. Phone numbers and emails are on there for both Bill and I.
There you go.
Okay. So now on to business here. There's only one word in the bio. I had to look up how you pronounce it. So hopefully I hit that one correctly. But the Consulate General of Israel to the Pacific Northwest out of San Francisco. That's Shlomi Kaufman. Okay, so talk about a work history, I guess. You know, most of us, we go to school and get a job. We might move a couple times, but yeah, we don't move that much. Okay, so he began his appointment as Israel's Consul General to the Pacific Northwest in August of 2017. He most recently served as policy advisor to the deputy foreign ministers based in Jerusalem, Israel. Over the course of his 20-year diplomatic career, he has served as Israel's deputy consul general in New York City, chief of staff to ambassadors in Washington, D.C., deputy ambassador in Thailand, deputy consul general in Shanghai. His past domestic foreign ministry positions included director of North American Economic Affairs, policy advisor to the deputy foreign minister, diplomatic advisor, and director of the International Department in the Parliament and Ministry of National Infrastructure.
That's a mouthful.
I'm like reading this thing. I'm thinking, okay, his resume must just be amazing. And he was in the Northeast Asia sector. So prior to joining the foreign ministry, he worked in the high-tech industry representing an Israeli company, Orbot, in South Korea, as well as a consultant to a leading Israeli company, ECI. So he has been all over the place. He was born in the Soviet Republic of Georgia and moved to Israel, immigrated to Israel at the age of 9. So I guess it would be fair to say he's like been there and done that.
Yeah.
And so they live in San Francisco at the moment. Who knows how long that'll last. And he's been married for 20 years and he has 2 kids.
I only got one tip. Don't buy rent.
rent. Good call. So thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you for having me, Irene and Bill. It's great to be on your show. Thank you for initiating this this discussion, this talk, and I appreciate that.
Well, we decided people should know more about A, Israel, from people who actually know, and B, you know, what goes on in these consulates. You know, we don't hear much about that, really. And
only thing that goes on is that's where the CIA hangs out, right? Isn't they hide out in all those consulates?
I guess. and what's his face, Snowden or whoever he is?
He's in the consulate.
He's lurking in the one in
Sweden or something. Yeah,
no, in some itty bitty place. Anyway,
yeah.
So, where do you want to start?
So you asked, you were, they were asking or teasing about the consulate, what the consulate do, et cetera. So, the consulate usually in, Israel has about 8 consulates in the United States. But we have consulates also in other countries, and usually consulate covers certain area, in the vast country and it works, to build bridges, with the, I would say with the state authorities, whether it's the governor's offices, whether it's the local legislators, with local academia, with local businesses, with local Jewish community, as well as other communities. And, we basically serve as the bridge between Israel and the Pacific Northwest, which for us covers Northern California, Oregon, Washington, Alaska, Idaho, and Montana. So, it's a very diverse area, very big area, hard to cover everything in one shot, in 1 month. Just the traveling takes a lot of time.
Oh, yeah. But, at least you didn't get stuck with Southern California, bonus.
Well, no, Southern California is covered by my dear colleague down in LA, so...
Sucker.
No, we kind of...
He drew the short straw. You got the good part of the country.
Exactly. Well, he got Hawaii and...
then there's that. So. You got to pay him off if you make him live in Southern California, I guess. You got to live in L.A., but you cover Hawaii, so...
Yeah, exactly.
Not a total loss.
Exactly. So this is what we do. So we build, we're basically bridge builders between people here and the people in Israel, and trying to reflect what's really happening on the ground in Israel. What are the realities? What is, as we say, Israel beyond the headlines, Israel, the real, you know, faces, the various faces of Israel, what Israel, is doing in the world, how does Israel contributing to make the world a better place? And,
right.
That's why we're here.
So if I was going to travel to Israel, would I contact your office if I wanted to learn more or find out where to go and where not to go and that sort of thing? Is that kind of what you do?
Well, absolutely. Well, it's part of what we do. We definitely encourage more tourism. By the way, I got to say that last year there was a growth in 20% in the tourism from the United States to Israel. We're looking at about 800,000 Americans who visited Israel. But yes, we will be happy to provide information about where to go, what to do, what are the main points of interest. Plus, Americans don't really need a visa to Israel, so it's an easy one. It's buying a ticket and flying over.
Right.
From
right.
San Francisco, 14 hours, and you're there on the ground.
Oh, is that all?
It's only 14 hours.
Shoot, it's just like Hawaii, but longer.
Dinner and a movie, and you're there.
You get 2 bags of pretzels on that one, if you bring them yourself.
But at least it's a direct flight and not...
Yeah.
And now it's 5 connections.
Yeah, lucky for you. Well, hold on. Before we do that, we have to take a really quick break. I know.
I'm loaded with questions on this deal.
Bill's got a lot of questions. Yeah. I didn't let him read the website or anything, so he's fresh into this. We are visiting with Shlomi Kaufman. He is the Consulate General of Israel to the Pacific Northwest out of San Francisco. And we'll have him on for this entire hour. You can find his information on our website at wethepeopleradio.us.
Boys, you gotta draw a hard line.
When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune, and we'll all meet back at the local saloon.
We'll raise up our glasses against evil.
We're back.
Okay. You are joining We the People again, and we're back with Shlomi Kaufman. All right, so Bill had questions. Sorry,
I cut Bill off at the pass. I think one of the more common things, you know, when Israel comes up is If I want to travel to Israel, is it safe? And, you know, I don't mean any disrespect or anything, but there's a lot going on in that area. Is it really safe to travel to Israel?
It is absolutely safe to travel to Israel. And as I mentioned to you earlier, we have an increase in 20% of the tourism just from the United States.
Hmm.
In last year, 20% just from the United States, we're up to 800,000 from the U.S. All over the world, we're looking at around 3 million people. Israel is a major destination for tourism. Jerusalem and the Dead Sea and other fascinating places and places that carry and tell the story of 4,000 years of history. And we have a pretty good security forces that do everything to ensure safety. And there is no question, and there is no doubt in my mind that it's safe. People are traveling back and forth happily and without any problem. So
good.
You know, sometimes news are sometimes the headlines are, you know, pretty bold, but the realities are in many cases different.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's easy to understand. I mean, I often wonder if people in other countries listen to what's happening in the United States and think that there's some kind of civil war going on over here, but it's not the case.
That's only Monday through Friday when Congress is in session.
Oh, that's true. That's only in Washington, D.C.
It's a localized insurrection.
I can tell you that I traveled to another country recently for vacation, and you know, an employer of mine came to me and said, "Well, there was a travel warning from the State Department to this country, and there were some, you know, terrorist activity, gang activities, etc." And I said, "Okay, but it doesn't mean that people are not traveling." And when I landed there, you don't feel anything. So it's perspectives. Perspectives are very important.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So, what's happening in Israel right now? If a person wanted to go over there, you know, most times people go over there, they want to visit the Holy Lands, and that is what else do we have going on in Israel that you might want to point people at?
So, of course, it's we have, as I mentioned earlier, 4,000 years of history, and you know, the whole biblical history that is basically in front of you. To talk about Jerusalem and the holy places in Jerusalem, to talk about places which are outside of Jerusalem, which are, you know, important to Christians, in the Christian world, the Capernaum and the Jordan River. But aside of the tourism and exploration of history is, of course, the innovation scene, all what's going on. I mean, Israel is considered like a second to Silicon Valley. A huge, huge tech investment going on in Israel, and a lot of innovation coming out of Israel. A lot of technologies that we are using today, which are so obvious to all of us, came out of this country, which was established 70 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Which started in the desert, and we have innovations which is in technology and software and in social entrepreneurship. So, as I said earlier, we're trying to make the world a better place, and the message is coming out of Jerusalem and of Israel. This tiny country, which is the size of New Jersey, and has about 8.5 million people. So, yes. There are challenges, and you know, there are challenges everywhere, not
sure
only in Israel. And we're definitely trying to work and make things better in technology. And you see, about 300 multinational companies have R&D offices in Israel. This is an enormous number.
Oh, sure.
There's no other country around us that has anything similar to this. We are, in terms of economy, one of the most leading. I mean, one of the 35 countries in the OECD, in the Organization of the Developed Countries. So, you know, there is a lot to see, and the distances are short, so a lot can be achieved and can be seen in 1 week.
So, Israel, you say distances are short. Compare the size of Israel to, say,
Well, he said New Jersey.
Yeah, New Jersey. Okay, so that, yeah, that gives you an idea. You could travel
I'm not
to
sure
border
how many
to
times
border.
You could fit New Jersey into California.
Yeah, a lot.
I'm guessing it's just a few.
Yeah, if you traveled border to border in California, you'd be driving day
like
and night.
12 hours.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. No, I've had a lot of people tell me that travel in Israel is safer and probably more secure than a lot of places in the United States. I think we could take some lessons from you guys.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things is, as a diplomat, you don't really compare things to the country that you're posted in.
No.
But, you don't?
Is that no,
like,
you don't.
Is that like bad form? Or, I mean, they just, you don't notice or you're not allowed to say?
It's not really, you know, it's not right to do.
Not kosher,
yeah,
huh?
Takes, yeah. No, it's not a PC, as you say, but...
I was trying to fit in. Somebody drop kosher and get
it. It takes about an hour, and some places an hour and a half, but other places it may take about an hour to cross Israel from east to west. And north-south is about, it's a little bit longer, 7 hours.
Right.
So, yeah, it's not the size what matters. The intensity, the values, and the energy.
Well, what are you thinking about this embassy move to Jerusalem from the United States? People seem to be pretty, well, if some people are really mad about it, which means it was probably a good idea.
Well, I can tell you that we thought that this is one of the, I mean, this was a great move, and we welcome that, and it's basically historical justice, because this is our capital.
Right.
That has been our capital forever. We prayed for 2,000 years out of the diaspora, and think about it. We are the only people who were basically sent out of its country, and for 2,000 years prayed to go to the same place, to return to Jerusalem. We never changed our prayer to be back in Jerusalem. We always said next year in Jerusalem. And we always looked from the east to the west, but from the west to the east, looking to one place, which is Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
When we say going back to Israel for Jews, we say we will climb up to Mount Zion, and that moving to Israel is climbing up to Jerusalem. So it's a historical move. It's a very important move. It sends the right message to the rest of the world, to the region, that about our belonging to this place.
Mm-hmm.
Not that we need this proof to ourselves, but it's important that it has been taken by the administration and sent the right message.
Well, I think there's so many people out there that, for one reason or another, don't know the history of Israel and don't understand why there's the turmoil there is in that region. But you have a true 2,000 year history of that land. So.
Well, and Jerusalem is a really diverse city. It isn't like it isn't like the people in Israel said, okay, everybody else get out. This is only for us.
Absolutely.
Being nice hasn't really gotten you anywhere.
Yeah. Well, our history, Bill, is in the Holy Land is over 4,000 years history.
Mm.
2,000 are, well, not at least, but 2,000 are in exile. But we always, there was always a Jewish presence in the Holy Land throughout all the 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And since the reestablishment of the State of Israel, and in 67 when we united Jerusalem, there was a freedom of worship to all the religions, to the Christians and to the Muslims and to the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, in our Declaration of Independence, this is one of the main messages. That Israel will be open and will be tolerant and will allow freedom of worship.
And that is really almost a unique position for your country to have you know, such a
especially when you're surrounded
presence.
By a lot of people that are.
I mean, we have freedom of religion here,
fans.
But to have that,
yeah, almost, to literally share a whole city
to share
evenly,
it. Yeah, yeah, that's.
Well, to share it is one thing, but also we don't have, as the United States, because of different reasons, we don't have a separation between the religion, the Jewish religion, and the state.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we allow this freedom. It's one of the pillars. So we have different, when you travel in Israel, you see the diversity. You see Christian, you see Arabs who are Christians and Arabs who are Muslims. You see Jews who go to very Orthodox Jews, but also secular Jews. You see, of course, Christians who are living in Israel. You see Armenians. You see the Greek Orthodox. You see the Druze community, which is more and more Middle Eastern. They have their own religion. We have this freedom. There is no other place around us that allows or would allow such a freedom of worship. Like Israel. And this is because of our tolerance and acceptance of the other.
Right, right. No, and I think that's quite unique.
I think if you were going to get a religious studies degree, you should go to Israel. You can hit everybody in one fell swoop. We have to take a really quick break, and when we come back, we will return here with our guest, Shlomi Kaufman. He is in San Francisco, actually. Well, I don't know if you're actually there right this minute. But he is currently Israel's consul general to the Pacific Northwest.
We'll
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
So you can find all this information on our website at wethepeopleradio.us. Be right back.
Nothing like a little Norman Greenbaum in the morning with my
coffee.
Can't
have too much Norman Greenbaum.
Yeah.
His one-hit wonder.
Yeah.
Poor guy. He was really on a roll. He just never got it rolling.
Couldn't
get past Spirit in the Sky. So what are some things, Shlomi, that we would not know that as a diplomat that you get to do or have to do and that the public maybe doesn't see that isn't secret, that we don't have to get killed after we learn it? Because we don't want to know.
No, there is nothing. There is nothing to the public. I mean, you know, we are here, as I said, we are here to build bridges and to talk to people and to reach out and to be the connectors. So there is the consuls usually they're very open public figures. So this is who we are.
Yeah.
Yeah, because when I met you, I mean, we had fun. You're super friendly, I thought.
Absolutely.
This would be great fun on the radio. Well, so how is it for the family? They have to kind of like to move. They get a really multicultural view of the world, especially on your, your route.
Yeah, absolutely. My wife has been traveling with me for the past 20 years.
Wow, good for her.
And she's been enjoying that. So,
do they get to go?
No, you got to have a partner that's really into this. Otherwise, it's starting to be pretty tough. It's not.
Yeah, that's true. It'd be a lot of what? You've got to go again. And a lot of packing. Do you?
Absolutely.
Like, my dad traveled a lot when we were kids. He worked for Travelers Insurance, and when they named it Travelers, they meant that. But we got to every now and then go with my dad to, like a convention or things like that. Are you allowed to take your family? Like if you go to Alaska or someplace, kind of fun, do you get to take them?
Yeah, we can combine the two. I mean, mostly it's not, it's not happening just because the kids are in school and so on, but,
True.
Here now and then, I mean, my kids are, in elementary school yet, so they have stuff to learn yet.
Yeah, and they have all that soccer or whatever all else they
have. Yeah, the weekends are usually busy because, you know, either baseball or soccer or something else.
Oh, yeah.
Do they do that as much in Israel? Are kids, like, booked 24 hours a day in Israel like they are here? I know you're not supposed to compare, but just, you know, kind of...
No, well,
off the record.
Off the record, sure. it's a little bit different here in Israel because here basically kids have 2 days off, and which is Saturday and Sunday. But in Israel, they study on Friday, and they have only 1 day off.
Hmm.
The weekend and usually because the on Saturday most businesses are not working, so kids are, you know, this is a time to devote for the family.
Right. So education in Israel, I have a feeling that education is probably a little more important there than in most places. We traveled to New York. One trip we took, and
Bill's first trip to New York, and we rode the subway.
one of my observations, and I'll never forget this, was you look around, and all the kids would have like a Game Boy, or they'd have their headphones in, listening to music, or playing some game or something, but. I noticed all the Jewish kids all were reading a book and studying, and I thought, wow, what a difference, you know? I mean, and it wasn't just like in one place. I saw this everywhere.
I told him, I said, I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood. It is a different culture, different priority, and very cool. I mean, unfortunately, we'd like you guys to maybe make that as some kind of like a vaccine, maybe. get it into some kind of a delivery system we could use.
I got to tell you that kids are addicted to technology in Israel as much as they are addicted to technology in other places.
Uh-huh.
But yes, education is a very vital part of the Jewish and Israeli culture.
Do the kids learn their history? I know in this country, we've really put history kind of on the back burner. In a lot of cases, we're kind of rewriting our own history.
The whole 200 years of it.
Yeah, the whole 200 years.
Let's just point out, it's a whole 200 years.
That's a lot to learn. But in Israel, do the kids, do they focus on their own history a lot there?
Well, first of all, we have, we study the Bible, or what is called the Old Testament, from pretty much fourth and fifth grade all the way until we graduate from high school.
Yeah.
And the idea is not so much about, you know, teaching you the religion, but to tell you the story, the biblical story of the Jewish people.
Right.
From the very beginning. To have this ingredient, to have this, to understand where we're coming from, why we're here. So, plus, the issue of history in our culture is a fundamental component, because we cannot, as a small people, as people who were persecuted, last week we commemorated the 6 million Jews in the Holocaust.
I saw that.
And we cannot, I mean, we have to remember where we came from.
Yes.
We have to remember, because to continue to exist and flourish where we are, the appreciation and understanding of the history is crucial. Because if you don't have, as we say, if you don't have an appreciation of the history, you don't understand the present, and it cannot look into the future. And learning about the modern history, how Israel was reestablished, what happened to the, you know, what happened during the Holocaust, the issue of anti-Semitism. This is all is being taught in schools, some of it in earlier stage, some of it in later stage. But yes, absolutely. We are born with that. So,
well,
we have a very st- strong sense of history.
And
I think the thing I learned as a kid growing up in Connecticut, and this was, you know, I told you this when we were chatting that day, but, mm-hmm. you know, it's funny to think as a little kid, we'd have sleepover parties, you know, so here would be a bunch of little, you know, 8, 9, 10-year-old girls, you know, in sleeping bags in somebody's basement, you know, we'd all be there in the, you know, dark at night talking. And what were we talking about? Well, half the kids where we grew up, you were either Catholic or Jewish. It was really easy. There were no other religions. So it was always, well, we don't get it. What nationality are you? And all of our Jewish friends would say, well, I'm Jewish. And we're like, no, that's like the place, but
that's your
religion. But you know, what nationality are you? And they'd say, well, we were Jewish. We had the hardest time as kids wrapping our mind around that. But as I've gotten older, you start to realize, like, I don't know if you know this, but the kids, in order to be bar mitzvahed and bat mitzvahed, they go to Hebrew school. And so they literally learn their language. And they, you know, I mean, it's not like here. It's not like us where we just...
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's
funny.
But
I mean, it is done in the U.S. if kids follow that. Do you find, Shlomi, is it mostly an East Coast thing? Because I don't really see much of the Hebrew school and all that on the West Coast.
No, there are Hebrew schools. There are Jewish day schools on the West Coast.
Maybe just bigger cities or something.
Yeah, like it's made in San Francisco and L.A. area, I guess in San Diego, too.
Sure.
I got to say that I'm not sure about Seattle. But there are several. I mean, there is a very big and flourishing and supportive community in the Bay Area and in Los Angeles. In the Bay Area, you have several. I mean, in the city, there is one Jewish day school, one high school. There is one East Bay. But down in the Silicon Valley area, you know, San Jose and Los Gatos, and there are several schools here because there is a very strong Jewish and Israeli community here. There are about close to 40,000 Israelis living just in the Silicon Valley
in
the Bay Area.
Wow.
And they are, you know, all these guys who are coming to work in the high-tech companies, who are coming, you know, to the innovators and founders of companies who are trying to raise, to look for investment and to look for collaborations in the technological world. This is what they're doing. And this is why we have such a flourishing community. And, of course, we have a big community down in Los Angeles.
Interesting. So, do you ever cross paths with people since that was your previous career? I don't know how long ago that was, but do you ever run into people you used to work in that industry with, or...?
Well, I run into people, I see people all the time because I'm all the time coming down to the Valley. I just, you know, now I'm the Silicon Valley Federation where they celebrate today the 70th anniversary for the State of Israel. And they kicked it off with a panel between two, important people, Israelis who are living here and who's been, you know, the bridge and the visionaries between the Valley and Israel. And one of them is a guy who's invested in very big companies, and very successful ones. So, there is a lot all the time.
That's kind of neat. Turned out to be a good, I'm sure they placed you there for a reason, but that's a really good fit for you.
Yeah.
Let's take our friendliest guy and let's put him in Silicon Valley where he speaks the lingo of the people who work there. It's good planning on your government's part. Yeah, smart.
Yeah,
all around smart guys. We have to take one more quick break and then we'll come right back. And I'm sure there are things that we've digressed on, huh? You can bring us back in line. We'll have 15 minutes to the top of the hour. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
If everybody's right, if everybody's wrong, young people speak in their minds, are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound?
Bye.
we're back. Yeah, Bill's got a question.
Hey, one of the hot topics in our country right now is our border wall and whether or not we should build it or not build it. And I would like to think we're going to build it. But I understand there's a section of the Israeli border that has a wall. How effective is that?
Big deep breath.
What?
There was like big deep breath. It's like, well.
No, it's all right.
Are we allowed to talk about that? Is that out of bounds?
Most of what it was called or what was presented as a wall is actually not a wall, but a fence. And there are certain parts along this fence which are, you know, certain, like a wall. And it tends to be effective. It tends to be effective in preventing terrorists crossing from the West Bank, into Israel. But, this is why it was built. It was built to prevent and stop terrorists crossing in different points that we couldn't control. Because we had, there were periods that were basically had people crossing, people on our side waiting for them, helping, and then we started to count, we were counting bodies. It turned to be effective. But, it's again, we're doing a lot of things that in our area we have to do in order to preserve people's life.
Oh, sure. No, I understand.
You guys are really clever with how you do your security. I mean, you're not a one-size-fits-all. You employ a lot of different techniques that are actually super effective.
And they're effective and they work. And that's, I think, why you're as safe as you are in Israel is because of the security measures. We have... at naturally a similar problem on our southern border, a lot of drug cartels coming across in different places. And naturally we have, illegal immigrants coming across, and I don't blame them a bit. They're coming from a horrible place and want to make a better life.
That's not what you said yesterday. Oh, sorry.
Don't put words in my mouth. But there's a huge controversy here as to how to secure the border. And stop a lot of this. I think they said in March there was like 50,000 people arrested. And they figured if they arrested 50,000, there were probably another 50 that got through. That's a lot of people crossing illegally over your border.
If 100,000 people came across the border of Israel, you guys would be overrun.
Yeah,
that would look like the running of the bulls. It's just that'd be crazy. I know that your security folks in Israel work with our Homeland Security, and because we've interviewed some of them before, and I know we share technology and techniques and ideas back and forth between our two countries. Do you ever have to do any of that stuff, or is yours? Are you really just Minister of Friendliness?
I was the executive minister of friendliness. No, I didn't have a chance to be part of this home security cooperation. So look, I know that we have very good relations between our I would say, generally speaking, between all our official departments and their counterparts in the United States. So we have a great cooperation between the two departments of agriculture, and we have great cooperation between the Commerce and the Homeland Security and the State Department. I mean, the United States is Israel's best ally, and Israel is the best ally to the United States. So we work intimately on so many levels that, you know, we can talk about each and one of them for probably another hour.
Sure.
Do you work with the other, I'm assuming, I've never looked, I know there's a Chinese consulate in San Francisco because I know somebody who had to go there, but are there a whole bunch of them, and are you guys in the same neighborhood, or are you spread around the city,
no,
and do you
no,
do things together?
Each one of us is probably, you know, is finding the property in its own place. I mean, we are based in one of the high-rise buildings, which are not too many of them in San Francisco, but...
And you have a fairly large staff too.
Well, it's not a big consulate, but we're trying to be as effective as possible. This is the key. It's not about size; it's about effectiveness.
Sure.
But by the way, you asked, we spoke about cooperation, different homeland security, but we have a very good Israel is also known for its agriculture and agrotechnology. And we have a lot of things going on between California and Israel in this field too. So that's, another field which is important, and especially in the area that you're more in the inner valley, it's something which is important to the industry here as well as to the industry in Israel.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, you guys, you do a lot of things. I was culling through your website last night looking for, things to post and information. And there's quite a bit of just educational stuff on there. News, events, speakers bureau, which is kind of great. So if somebody was having an event and they wanted to learn more, there's a speakers bureau. Lots of things, returning residents. You guys, there are translators. I thought all these things that we don't particularly think about. How long do you work in a job like this in one location? Is there a specific time?
Usually it's limited to 4 years. It can be extended maximum to 5, but then after 5 we go back. The the reasoning for that is basically that. One is to get connected back to where you're coming from. The second is to allow other people to go out and serve. And three, also to refresh yourself. It takes, these jobs require a lot of energy, a lot of time. It's in many cases around the clock. We're having this interview now, but I gave a speech just about half hour before the interview, and I'm about to give another speech in about 10 minutes from now. So,
so the Minister of Friendliness gig is very busy.
And I had to work on these speeches just this morning because yesterday I had to spend some time with my kids. So that's the way it works.
So it isn't a particularly relaxing thing. So when you're in the off assignment time, like after, say, it's 4 years and then they pull you back, is there a time period that you're off and then you get reassigned to another place?
Yeah, but it depends very much on my decision, on one's decision to apply for an overseas post.
Oh, okay. So once you're in the system, you're not doing that forever necessarily.
No, it's not that they force you to go out on an assignment.
I think once you get all trained, they might want to keep you.
There is an expectation to go, back and forth, but the intervals in which you spend time back in Israel, the headquarters are not limited. The personal circumstances are not working in favor of living, so one can stay in Israel.
Right.
We don't kick people out. So.
Yeah, that's probably a good thing. Yeah, it was pretty interesting because I was looking here that you guys and you would kind of explain this. You coordinate relationships between the State of Israel and then our U.S. national state. Local organizations, businesses, offices of public officials, and citizens within the U.S. Mm-hmm. Pacific Northwest. So you pretty much have everybody You know, well, I mean, I kind of laugh. Our congressional district here is 11 counties, and it feels really big. And then I read your list. I'm like, man, it's not really that,
not really that big.
It's not such a big deal.
Yeah. No, it is a big area. And by the way, my case is a better case because I have some colleague. I have at least one colleague who covers 9 states. So.
Oh. That's a tricky deal. Well, and you just got here. You started this, I'm not looking at that page, but what, September of last year?
Yeah, August.
Nice. So you're here for a while. So as things happen, as the world becomes, I'm sure, more interesting rather than less, if you have things
Play
that...
Place.
Yes, if you have things that you'd like to share, we'd love to have you come back on since we know where you are now. And
so
approximately how long
so
you'll be there.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. And, well, I hope you get a little time maybe later today to hang out, do nothing.
Yeah, in an hour.
Yeah.
All right. Well, is your speech right at 1? You have a minute and a half you're to get there. So
it's what?
I feel the pressure. I'm feeling the pressure. If your speech is at 1, well,
no, it's. As long as I'm not calling him, okay.
Okay, all right. So it's not so bad. Yeah. Well,
very good.
No, but it was great to be on the show with you, and it's a great opportunity to send the message out and to tell what we're doing.
Absolutely, and if people are thinking of traveling, I mean, this I had no idea. I haven't been to somebody's consulate website, and I thought, geez, there's a ton of information there.
So we'll be happy to see you not only visiting our website but also following our Twitter, but more than that, coming to visit Israel.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks for being with us, and we will get we'll get together again.
And
we'll
have an opportunity to do that, we're calling you before we go. We're going to learn all sorts of good stuff.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Shlomi.
Thank you so much.
Have a great day, and thank your family for the time they gave up for us. Much appreciated. We will be back next hour. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Good afternoon, and welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. We're shifting gears. We're shifting hard. Chatted about Israel the first hour with the consulate general. I never know what to call him exactly. See, the consul general or the consulate general? It's both. It's both on everything.
Hmm.
I can't decide.
Not a consulate.
Yeah. So you know, one time when I'm not talking to him, when I have people listening, I'm going to ask him, "All right, which is it? And why is it so confusing?" So this hour is going to be much simpler. We're going to talk about something we don't actually know a lot about it, but at least it's familiar. Familiar territory, education. We're here with Peter Murphy, Vice President for Policy at the Invest in Education Foundation. So Peter's the Vice President, and he has held that position since it was founded in 2012. It's Invest in Education Coalition promotes school choice and improving K-12 education. And I don't think anybody out there listening would say, oh, no, we don't need to do that. It's all good. We've got that all handled. Because we don't have that handled. So today we'll be discussing their important campaign to promote school choice through a national K-12 scholarship tax credit. So Peter was previously a communications director at the New York Charter Schools Association and statewide membership organization of charter schools in New York, which advocates on behalf of the state's more than 200 charter schools in operation. That's pretty awesome. 200. I don't know how many they have out here, but that's kind of great. Peter, are you in there? You're awfully quiet.
I'm here.
Okay.
Oh, there he is.
So I'm Aaron. We forgot to tell you that. You're like listening to people you've never met. We haven't even emailed with each other. I know who you are. You know, there's a weird little kid who texts me that periodically, but I had to call the police about that. So. I'm trying to cut back on I know who you are. I'm trying to stop making special friends, I guess is what I'm saying. And so, Bill, say something. So,
oh yeah, I'm Bill Cundiff. I'm the co-host here, and the sponsor of this hour is Team Power.
Did you see the way he just took that over?
Oh yeah. Well, we're just gonna go with it because you're kind of flopping around over there like a fish out of water. Yeah, you're all right. All right, I'll get you back on track. Team Power is our local John Deere and Kubota dealer, and right now, if you're looking for a great deal on a tractor, go see those guys. They have a full inventory of tractors, every shape and size.
How full is it?
It's really full. They're at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake, just north of Redding, and just south of Phil's Propeller. If you drive up the freeway, you can't miss them. Their phone number is 226-9226, and right now they're making some great deals. So go in there and see them. Either buy a tractor, get your tractor fixed, get your any kind of equipment, we can work on it and get it fixed up for you. Team Power.
Yeah, and if you have spare time on your hands, just go, talk to the salesman for hours on end and have him walk you around and show you all the different models.
Yeah.
Oh, no, wait, don't.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
Yeah.
I remember those days. All right. So we're going to swerve right back to education there. I forgot about the sponsorship part. Obviously, I'm not the marketing director. So
no, you're not.
I can talk tractors, too, by the way.
You can? What?
I can talk tractors too.
Oh,
see, there you go.
What kind of tractors? What color tractors are you talking?
Well, it's not John Deere. My father-in-law was a John Deere guy. I have something else.
What
God bless
have?
Him.
Cub Cadet.
Well, you know what? I used to work for International Harvester, so I can relate to Cub Cadet.
Isn't there a song about that?
Yeah, that's right. So. Talk to us about education. This
more tractors.
This new education foundation. What can you tell us?
What are you guys up to?
Well, we got established in 2012, and we were primarily focused on New York State, which has a robust charter school program, which I was involved in, as you mentioned, years before that. And really, the next step was to try and get more scholarship opportunities through K-12 education, because so many children in our state and so many children in California, particularly in these high-needs urban areas, really have inadequate schooling. And the public schools in so many of these urban areas, high-needs neighborhoods, are not going to get fixed overnight. They're not going to get fixed in 3, 5, 10 years, probably, sadly, not in our lifetime.
Well, but Peter, we could just throw money at it, can't we? We just keep pouring money into it. That's fixing it.
Well, that experiment failed, but you wouldn't know that from talking to the usual suspects.
Oh, my gosh.
Politicians who throw money at it, teacher unions, school district officials. And look, I don't begrudge anyone for wanting more money, asking for more money. That's understandable.
Unless it's my money.
But there's so much more that's necessary for education, and the political forces are such that it's very difficult to get change that happens quickly. And the trouble is, children grow up quickly, as any parent can tell you. Children, age fast, and we have one chance to get this right and provide them a quality education. So we felt the need to get beyond charter schools, because obviously a lot of children still can't get into charter schools. They have their own challenges in terms of rapidity and getting up and running, and many parents lose out on the lottery because they're oversubscribed, the enrollment admission process in these charter schools. And so we set out to get a scholarship program launched in New York State, which other states have, and the way to do that is to provide a tax incentive for more charitable donations to go into private scholarship funds, so children from low-income households and working-class families can get scholarship funds and put their child in the best school they can find for them, the most suitable education for them, the way that rich people and upper-income people already have.
Is there a big demand? As far as the scholarship applications, big demand there? You get a lot more than you have available? Or?
Well, there's an enormous demand. Right now, you have one of the better-known scholarship funds in this that is based in the city of New York, is called the Children's Scholarship Fund. And they have partnerships throughout the country, but most of their scholarships are given out in New York City. And I think they give out about 15 or 16,000 scholarships a year, not a huge number. And they're vastly oversubscribed. I mean, parents just would kill for that opportunity. And these are scholarships, mind you, that don't pay the full tuition, right? They're just, they affect the families at the margin. So parents have to have skin in the game here. And parents make enormous sacrifices to put their child in the best school they can.
Oh, sure.
And so the scholarship opportunity, I mean, you know, makes a big difference, and for thousands of parents makes enough of a difference to change the whole trajectory of a child's life. And so that's what we're trying to affect here. And we came very close to getting something passed in the state legislature to expand the donation incentive, the tax donation incentive here in New York. We came up short. And now we're really focused on this nationally, because many states like New York and California really resist this kind of education reform. The teacher unions have the governors and the state legislatures in this vice grip, and it's very difficult to overcome that. And so many people coin school choice as a 21st century version of civil rights, and I think that's a very apt description. And we're looking to the federal government to advance a civil right for particularly low-income households in this country, advance that civil right, and overcome the resistance that we see in state capitals throughout the country.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that. The teachers' unions and such do have somewhat of a stranglehold on our California agencies, and we need to take a break. When we come back, let's talk a little bit more about that, how, you know, the common citizen can get access to these funds, and, you know, what types of programs are actually available outside the norm. So we'll take a break and be right back.
And be right back.
Sometimes the devil's on the loose in our school system. So,
I was thinking that to Run Through the Jungle, that was kind of good. That was the playground.
The playground, yeah. It's just it's terrible. So, Peter, we're talking about public schools or the lack of. How does a parent today navigate the public school system that, as far as I'm concerned, is in shambles? We've got a teachers' union that has a stranglehold on the state government. We've got people trying to homeschool their kids and get nothing but grief, you know, toe the line, you know, inspections. You know, they want the kids in public schools strictly for the money. It's become more about the money than it is about actually getting the kid a good education. And as a person that has to hire people that come out of our public schools, I'm shocked at what our public schools are putting out. And it's embarrassing when these kids get out of school and they can't do common math problems. They can play on the computer. They're really good with that.
Come on, your last employee quit by sending you a text message.
Well, their feelings were hurt, yeah. So, you know, I didn't provide a safe space and a teddy bear and all that. But so okay, I'm off my soapbox, Peter. Go ahead and tell us what we can do here.
Peter, pull Bill out of the trees. Pull Bill out of the trees. Come on.
Not to be facetious or anything.
Oh, come
right?
on, do it.
Yeah.
Well,
that's just my opinion. I could be wrong.
Public schools have been around a long time. They'll always be with us. They should always be with us.
Absolutely.
And they work really well for a lot of families in the country. Let's just stipulate that. This is not some broad brush condemnation of public ed. Not
well, it was when
that.
Bill did it.
Don't
but...
believe that.
Okay.
But for a lot of places, it doesn't work. And there's enormous resistance to change. And it's over time you have this calcified effect of these lengthy the labor contracts that really govern how schools are run and how teachers are managed. And any education, any school setting is a very labor-intensive business. And you have a system throughout the country, in every state, in every locality. It's very difficult. It's the one industry where it's difficult to actually hold people accountable for their performance.
Yeah, I was going to say the biggest problem is accountability.
And you can't throw money at it.
Fundamental problem. That's the fundamental problem and shortcoming of public ed. You cannot hold the employees for performance. Every other industry,
except the VA,
even many in the public sector, you can do that. You cannot do that in education. And so, as a result, I think, and look, teachers face enormous challenges, right? I mean, for instance, this whole, and I'm not an expert on discipline, I just put this out there for thought, that when you have the federal government starting to dictate disciplinary policies in local schools, and that you're bringing out quote-unquote guidance about, you know, how you discipline kids, well, look, I mean, if there's one place I'm enormously sympathetic to teachers, it's this tying their hands to discipline kids and remove unruly children from the classroom. It's outrageous that their hands would be tied and kept from doing that. So I think that's the place the union needs to fight.
No, I agree. I think teachers and cops, I mean, there's, you put a teacher in a classroom that's overcrowded to start with, and then they have no, really have no authority to maintain.
And the kids, of course, never pick up on that.
No, they never do.
No, not at all.
And there's a lot of, probably the majority of the kids do want to learn, but it doesn't take very many of them that just mess up the whole game.
That's exactly right. And so, I just think it's an enormous disservice that's going on in many places of the country where learning isn't happening because the tail's wagging the dog. You know, the unruly children, you're not permitted to discipline them the way they need to be. And that's disruptive for everyone else. And so that's one set of issues. And there is pushback on that, in the Trump administration to pull that back and leave it to the purview of the states and localities to make those decisions. I think that's a good step.
Mm-hmm.
But even that effort by Betsy DeVos and in the Trump administration is getting resistance from, you know, the advocates, so to speak.
From the resistance.
What's that?
Yeah, from the resistance.
Literally. Right. So you have that issue. But what educational choice does is it just enables families of limited economic means to overcome that and say, you know, we're not stuck in this place. We're not stuck in our neighborhood school. We have flexibility. We have the ability to move and to change, and that's a good thing. And I don't begrudge teachers and public schools from getting whatever money they can extract out of state legislatures and Congress. Where it rubs me the wrong way is how they advocate against a better opportunity for children outside of their system. It's like it's all about this monopolistic control, and that's where I just find it really offensive that they're advocating against opportunities elsewhere in education. And that's the thing, that's the challenge for school choice that you have to overcome, that very pervasive, strong, and widespread opposition to what we're trying to do. Now, there's been enormous progress in school choice. It's been ongoing for 30 years. Charter schools have proliferated. Scholarship programs, tax credit programs have proliferated. 18 states have that now. Now you have education savings accounts that are starting to spring up around the country. 6 states have those. So it's ongoing, but it's been a slog, and there's been a lot of resistance along the way.
Well, I think the I should point out, too, there's a your executive director, Thomas Carroll, had an article in The Hill, and I don't know the date on that, actually. I posted the article and the link to The Hill, but I don't know what date. I think it was had to be pretty recent, entitled Trump's School Choice Victory is Just the Beginning. And it's actually it's very well written, and it explains what you guys are basically looking to do. So if somebody wanted to do more research, you could find that on our site there at wethepeopleradio.us. And that'll link you right directly there. Talk to me about this, how this connected with the tax bill, or did it? Was it supposed to be in the tax bill, but then wasn't? Or?
Right. So back in December, the tax reform bill that just rewrote so many, you know, hundreds of provisions of the tax code, there was a provision that we advocated very strongly for, to use what are called 529 college savings accounts. These are tax advantage savings accounts to encourage families to save for their children's college.
And those currently exist.
Oh yeah, they've been around for 20 years.
Okay.
13 million Americans have them. They're probably worth near $300 billion in the aggregate right now. And they've been a very meaningful, effective savings vehicle for families to save their kids' college. And so Congress created these back in 1996 or 7. And each state followed the Congress and started their own kind of tax incentives to help people make those contributions and save on that growth tax-free over time. So they've been a very successful savings vehicle. What the Congress did in December was to allow what they call a qualified withdrawal. You can withdraw from your savings accounts for specific purposes, namely higher education expenses, right? College savings program. What the Congress did was to say, now you can use those savings as a qualified withdrawal to spend on K-12 tuition. If you're sending your child to a private or religious school, or even a non-resident public school, right? Some parents can actually send their child to another district they don't live in and pay tuition. If you do one of those three things, you can withdraw those savings in the 529 plan to pay that tuition. We think that was a great step forward, not a panacea, not a game changer necessarily, but a really positive step forward. Of course, there was enormous pushback on that, large resistance from the teacher unions, but it passed. However, Aaron, one provision that did not get included was the homeschool part of that.
Oh.
You mentioned homeschoolers earlier. What the Senate amendment allowed for was homeschool families to have 529 accounts and use for their homeschool expenses. That was then disallowed by the Senate parliamentarian as, not germane and violating the reconciliation rules, blah, blah, blah. And so that got knocked out. But still, it was a big step forward because now 529 savings can be used for K-12 tuition. That's a good thing. But it's not enough. We've got to build on that. We've got to do more, and there's plenty more to do, and there's plenty of opportunities for the Trump administration and Congress to do a lot more in this area and have real, real immediate results for children. I think that's what's so effective about school choice, that the kinds of things we're talking about, K-12 scholarship funds, education savings accounts, they can really make an immediate impact. This is not an impact that comes in gradually over 5 or 6 years. Meanwhile, the child goes from, age 8 to age 14. I mean, that's too long a period to really help them.
Yeah, next thing they're out of the system.
Well, it's kind of crazy. Right. I mean, it's one thing if it was government, if you're looking at government funding, and I realize when you give a tax credit, you are kind of pulling money out of the mix, but it's money people have earned. I mean, why can't they put it aside and use it for their kids' education? It always blows my mind. The Senate, I don't know, it's like the most inexplicable place. Things go there and just come out totally upside down.
Or don't come out at all.
Right, exactly.
That's where good legislation goes to die.
Using the tax code, so you mentioned, the best school choice vehicle is not government spending, vouchers, adding a new program. I don't think that's really the way to go. That does not allow for kind of certainty and longevity.
Race to the bottom worked.
Pardon me?
Race to the bottom worked. It was enormously successful. They just called it Race to the Top by accident.
I think there were some good things that came out of Race to the Top. I mean, it did in New York, for instance, where I'm from, it did for kind of not forced, but certainly greatly encouraged the state legislature to increase the amount of charter schools that were available. That happened in other states. So that aspect of it, I think, was very positive. But there's some downsides to it. One of the things Race to the Top did was sort of usher in this idea of core curriculum,
yeah,
which a lot of parents rebelled against. And the interesting story there, and I always marvel when I hear the teacher unions condemn core curriculum. They were part of core curriculum. They were all for it,
yeah,
back in 2009 and 2010. And then when the parents rebelled, the teachers union acted like it was someone else's doing, when they were right there promoting it at the outset.
It's because there was such a huge outcry.
We want it. We don't like it anymore.
Yeah.
We have to take a really quick break, Peter. We will be back. And I want to get into some more about this, how you guys can expand it and maybe what our listeners can do to be more aware, because you work with some 70 other organizations. So let's tie that together when we return. You are listening to We the People. You can join us online at wethepeopleradio.us. Back. Okay, so Peter, before we run out of time, we're not running out of time yet, but it always happens. Where,
Aaron, I love the classic rock bumper music. CCR now BTO.
We have others. We have others. There are others. You know, I stopped listening to music really somewhere in the early 80s.
That was a good time to stop listening.
I've listened to, it's like, what is this and what are they saying? Please take me back to a time when I can understand what they're saying. Besides that, there was so much good. There was great political music back then. Works nicely for us. Okay, so how are we going to tie in with all these other, 70 different organizations? I know you can't list them all for us. They're probably on your website, but
so we have started up the Invest in Education Coalition. Started up an initiative called the EdTaxCredit50.org, EdTaxCredit50.org. And on our website there, the initiative's website, we have actually over about 250 organizations now who've signed up in support of a K-12 scholarship tax credit for Congress to enact so that children throughout the country, in every state, in every urban area, to be able to obtain a K-12 scholarship and send their child to the school that best meets their needs. This is, it's important to have a 50-state solution here because, again, only about 18 states have a state tax credit scholarship, and even among those, most of those programs are fairly modest. You have maybe four or five states that have very robust programs with a lot of participation, states like Arizona and Florida, Pennsylvania. But we need to do much more. And there's just too many children getting cheated right now in the years where we need to rescue them. And Congress has a role there. There's an enormous opportunity for the Trump administration to correct a very real problem and to correct it quickly. And so what we've tried to do to get away from Race to the Top and No Child Left Behind, these were initiatives that were very top-down, very Washington-directed.
And we all know they do such a great job.
Yeah, well, what this does instead is to use the tax code and direct private investment, private charitable donation, to invest in scholarship programs, to invest in children, to give them a way out, to give their families a better education for their children, and drive much more charitable money into these scholarship funds, which every state has such programs, privately operated programs. I mentioned the Children's Scholarship Fund based in New York, which has partnership programs throughout the country, in about a dozen areas around the country. And so if we can get more charitable money into the hands of families, it's going to drive choice and opportunity throughout. And just as an indicator of how effective this really is, this is something that teacher unions are dying on the hill about. I mean, this is something they just cannot countenance, and they fight tooth and nail every time. The last state to do this at the state level was Illinois, and it was enormous odds to overcome, but the teacher unions know the effectiveness of this, which is why they fight so hard against it. So we need Congress and the President to step up and get this done nationally.
So is this, you mentioned Arizona and Florida is having a robust program. Is this something they've incorporated, or what are they doing differently than the other states?
So what Florida did, for example, now they don't have a state income tax, a personal individual income tax, but they have a corporate income tax. And what they allow companies to do is make a donation to scholarship funds and get a tax credit for it, meaning that whatever you donate comes off of what you owe the state up to a certain limit.
Mm-hmm.
So it really drives a lot of money into
scholarship. That's a great idea.
So what you have then in Florida, you have over 100,000 children now, just annually. And this is built up over the last 17 years. They've had this program on the books. You have over 100,000 children in Florida from low-income households that are going to private schools because of it.
Right.
Well, that's pretty
Yeah, because people would rather give money to education than give it to the government, because one way or the other.
Exactly, as long as it's going to be spent, for something that will actually help.
And look, using the tax code this way to affect private money, to direct private investment, I mean, that's not new. That's been going on since the dawn of time, really. And you hear about that in economic development schemes. And I mean, you even have it for, we want movies to be filmed in our state, so we'll give these movie moguls a big tax break. Well, okay, maybe that's defensible, I don't know. But in this case, let's use it for education. Let's use the tax code to drive money into education so that people can make their own decisions and have more freedom to choose something better for their child. And look, for most families, they're satisfied, their public school works for them. And that'll continue, and it should continue. But for many others, let's do something efficacious for them. And that's what these scholarship tax credit programs have been doing. We've seen it work at the state level in several places. States are laboratories of democracy, as the saying goes. It's time to make this national.
It looks like a lot of I was looking on your edtaxcredit50.org website and the people that are connected to this, and a lot of them are Christian schools. You have a lot of religious schools and in this, and it seems like they're looking for the innovation, which makes sense.
Well, right. I mean, more than three quarters, maybe 80% of private schools are actually having a religious affiliation. So it stands to reason that they would be promoters of this. And many religious schools are, they face challenges and Catholic schools have been closing for the last 40 years for various reasons. And so that's one example. But for many families who can't afford it, Latino families, African American families, they want that structure and that discipline and that value system in their child's schooling. But they can't access it. They don't have the money. They don't live in the nice area to do that. So this is something that can give them that access. And again, we've seen this work now. What the scholarship tax credit would do would be to expand it so more resources flow to these scholarship funds and more families get the help they need.
Well, that makes sense. I was looking down your list. I don't know, maybe it's just me, but how is it I pick these things? So as I'm flipping down the list, I see there's an organization called GHETTO, G-H-E-T-T-O, that obviously is an acronym, but it doesn't say what it was. So I clicked on it to find out what it is, and it goes to a blank page. So apparently apparently we don't have a GHETTO.
The
ghetto's fixed.
These are real folks that do work, in the communities.
Yeah.
throughout the country. Some are small, some are larger.
Yeah, because you have like Homemakers of America.
Getting a better education for children.
Yeah, Homemakers of America. I mean, there's really, it's a huge variety of people that
are plugged
in.
And we have labor unions.
Oh, I didn't see those.
We have law enforcement and firefighter unions that have, you know, many of whom grew up and were educated in Catholic schools, people who fight fires.
Oh, yeah, here you go. Professional firefighters, Fraternal Order of Police, state troopers, and here's the Supreme Court Officers Association. I mean, yeah, you guys have cast a wide net.
There's a strong connection to religious education that many of the people who run these unions and many of these people who protect us on a daily basis, they're Catholic school products, many of them. They want that for their kids.
I am. Is that where I got my spicy attitude?
So many of these labor unions have been in favor of this kind of thing. They want it for their kids. It works for their children. And they want to see it to grow and expand. And so they've gotten on board with our effort. So right now, Aaron, we have there is a bill in Congress that was introduced by Congressman Lloyd Smucker from Pennsylvania. And it's called the USA Workforce Tax Credit Act. And it has the K-12 scholarship piece we've talked about. But it has an added element, and that is in a growing economy, you know, one of the things that many companies are faced with right now is lack of skilled workforce, because many children have gone through the K-12
yes.
system, not gotten the education they need. They lack the skills that these companies are looking for, and jobs have gone begging, unfilled. And so this has a dual purpose of both encouraging people to invest in scholarship funds and make charitable donations to those for K-12 opportunity, and then secondly, to encourage businesses to invest in workforce development and skills training, so children that are coming out of this maybe with a college or maybe with a high school diploma or even a college diploma to get the kind of skills that these companies are looking for now.
Sure.
Well, that was one of the platforms that Trump ran on was job training. You'd get these kids out of high school and pay companies to hire them and train them on the job. And so they can be, you know, they can develop some sort of job skills that they can use to you know, better themselves.
Hey, Peter, tell me, do you have the bill number? And I'll post that for people.
Yes, I do. It's H.R. 5153.
5153. Okay.
And I would encourage your listeners to call a member of Congress. Tell them to get on board, co-sponsor that bill, and get it done this year. And you know, look, job training is not a new idea, obviously. I mean, government runs job training programs, but who are the best determiners of the skills that are needed? It's companies that are looking to fill jobs.
Yep.
They're the ones that know what they need. So let's give them the tax incentive to make that investment and get that quick turnaround, as opposed to sort of a government bureaucracy that thinks it knows what the private sector needs. I don't know too many bureaucrats who spent much time in the private sector. Let's give that tax incentive to the businesses who are trying to fill the jobs now. That's what Lloyd Smucker's bill does, 5153.
Well, plus it's closer to the source, because every, you know, all communities aren't the same. I mean, they just aren't the same. We're in far northern California. We have very, very different wants, needs, and desires, and all points in between, then, say, the folks
it's a kid coming out of
Southern
school
California
with a big high-tech type skills is going to be hard-pressed to find a job in this area. I mean, there's just no high-tech around here. So, yeah, that makes total sense.
One of the things Congressman Smucker talked about, we had a meeting with him recently, and he himself comes from a business background. He started a sheetrock contractor way back, and it just became a larger construction contractor that he operated. But the average age of a welder in this country is in their early 50s.
Yep.
The average welder's age is in the early 50s. So who's going to be doing the welding? Who's who's going to be repairing the bridges?
Yeah.
Right. We need those jobs filled, and they pay well.
Yeah, plumbers and all these things. Our trades are really struggling. We have to take a really quick break, Peter. We'll come back and finish up with you to the top of the hour, and probably better make us talk about stuff that if we've skipped around. Otherwise, you know what's going to happen.
We always stay right on point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right, we'll be right back. I'm adding this bill number and all that stuff to the webpage at wethepeopleradio.us.
God bless you, please, Mrs. Robinson. Heaven holds a place for those who pray. Hey, hey, hey.
Too many lives they spin across the ocean. Too much money.
A little Skinnered at you there.
So do you like Mrs. Robinson? I wasn't sure what kind of a sense of humor you had, but anyway.
Uh-oh.
Are there? Peter's in the cone of silence.
No, I'm here.
There. Well, you were in the cone of silence on our end. yeah, anyway, I'm like, I don't know how old he is. I don't know what kind of a sense of humor he has, but Mrs. Robinson should get a laugh out of him a little bit.
Well, hey, I saw Simon and Garfunkel in Central Park in 1981.
Exactly.
Big reunion tour. Back when reunions meant something.
Yeah, actually. Yeah, really. Yeah, when they had the actual original people because it was a reunion. Now the reunion.
Now it's like reunion every 3 years to pay the bills.
Yeah, you know? No kidding. It's abused. All right. So, what have we missed on this, or not covered that people should know?
Well, I think it's important for folks to not be discouraged. This is an ongoing fight. It's a war. It's long term, and you know, democracy still exists in this country. It's sometimes it's hard to believe when you watch the news. It looks like a big insider's game, but Congress members really do react to their constituents. It's not the only thing they react to. It's not the only influence path, but people need to get active and make phone calls and not just that, not just for, say, a school choice issue, but just get active locally. Speak up in their local schools. Talk to their principals. It's their child's education at stake here. And, you know, it's very important to make your voice heard. Because people do listen, and the cumulative effect of that, and that's really what this is about, it, and why we're doing what we're doing and building this coalition and getting these 250 organizations from across the country. It's amassing a coalition of voices to make an impact in Congress and in state legislatures so people get heard and action takes place and we accomplish something. It's one step at a time.
Well, I think sometimes people feel like, as far as the education side of it goes, that it's a big lift. What about the people that are homeschooling? Ashley was saying she has a friend that homeschools, and this all seems to cut around them.
Well, homeschoolers to me do probably the biggest public service that one could ask for. They're educating their own children. And there is, most states have some degree of oversight to ensure that they're doing some minimal effort there. But homeschooling has been enormously successful in this country. And, you know, we constantly read about how well homeschool children are and go into college and just excel vis-a-vis their peers. So homeschool families, to me, make a big sacrifice, but they do an enormous public service because, look, where they're living, they're still paying taxes, right? They're supporting the public school system. Nobody's exempt from that. And yet they're not an expense on that system. You know, they're incurring the expense themselves and saving the public system the expense of educating their child. And so I think that deserves some respect, and I think that deserves some support. And that's the attempt that was made in last December that we talked about earlier, where the Senate Congress tried to get homeschool expenses qualified for 529 plans. That failed.
Yeah, and that ultimately was clobbered by Ron Wyden, that idiot from Oregon, just north of us, and Bernie Sanders.
And again, I go back to a very, really sad development that I've observed in my career over the last 20 years, where education reform, at least parts of it, charter schools in particular, used to be a very bipartisan issue. I mean, Bill Clinton was an enormous champion of charter schools, and he did great, you know, really great things while he was president. He started the whole charter school funding program that helped schools get that critical startup funding when they were just getting approved at the state level, but they had like a year and a half to open, so money wasn't flowing yet at the state level. They weren't having any kids, but they weren't having any, you know, enrollment, but there's enormous expenses in starting and opening a charter school. And the federal government, thanks to him and his leadership, stepped in and got that done. Charter schools were a very bipartisan education reform. 20 years later, it's like maybe like other issues in our country, the nation's very divided. The parties are very divided. They're sort of dug in on opposite camps.
Mm-hmm.
And I've talked to many Democrats, particularly in my home state of New York, and they know this. They know school choice is a good thing. They know scholarship funds are a good thing, that their own constituents would stand to gain enormously from such programs. And yet they can't bring themselves publicly and defy the teachers union and get it done, because the teacher unions have basically camped out now with the Democrats, and they're in this vice grip of the teacher unions, political support. And even you know, Governor Andrew Cuomo back in New York was, at one point during the last 7 years, was actually advocating for a number of educational choice initiatives, and he has since backed off of that because the teacher unions got to him. And it's an unfortunate development because he can do an enormous amount of good and change the lives of children throughout the country, you know, throughout the state of New York, certainly, and being a model and an example. And he's just chosen not to do it. He's camped out, you know, with the kind of traditional system and the traditional way of doing things. And a lot of kids lose by that.
Yeah.
So that's an unfortunate development. The partisanship of school choice these days is, I think, a very sad, you know, development, because it shouldn't be a partisan issue. It should be a very nonpartisan issue. And again, and I would just stress, Aaron, that one of the things that I've said over and over again is, and I deal a lot with legislators on this subject. If you're for school choice, it's not like you're against public schools, right?
Right, but that's the way the argument's framed.
Exactly. Yeah. The teacher union's message to legislators is, if you're for that, you're against us.
Yep.
You know, and that's
you hate public school.
If you're for bridge repair, you're not against public education. If you're for environmental protection, you're not against public education. If you're for school choice and educational opportunity, you're not against public education. You can be for both. And the teachers paint it very, you know, us versus them. And I think that's counterproductive. It's completely erroneous. It's dishonest. And I think politicians, it's very important for them not to fall for that ruse, that they can be for both. You could be the steadfast, strong supporter of public education, as every elected official should be, and also be for educational opportunity and choice for families that want that for their child.
Yeah, unfortunately, the in a lot of cases, not in all cases, but the teachers' unions are for teachers' benefits and not the students'
but
benefits.
It doesn't benefit the teachers either. That's the bad part.
Well, it does, because they get, you know, the districts get more money with the more kids they get.
Oh, and
get
they give it all to the teachers.
Well, not really. But, I mean, when you have, you know, overcrowding in the schools, then they're going to throw more money at you. And,
yeah,
you know,
that's true.
It's kind of a vicious circle. But you're right. It, just because you're for school choice doesn't necessarily mean you're against public schools.
I don't know a single politician. What lunatic politician would be against public schools?
Yeah.
It makes no sense. And none of them are. I've never met anyone who is. But you have them they are for choice, and yet they're painted as somehow against public schools, or they're going to hurt neighborhood public schools. It's crazy. But that's what's spoken of. And again, unions have a very vital role in our society. They fight for better working conditions, wages, benefits. That, you know, I don't begrudge that to any teacher, but when they get into the political realm and their goal is to deny an opportunity elsewhere, you know, that's where the fight
right.
exists.
Yeah.
And that's where the acrimony has built up.
It's interesting the word choice brings up, you know, like the VA has this, they have a program called Choice, and the big opposition to that is through VFW, American Legion, AMVETS, all of the large service groups object to veterans having a choice other than VA. They want them trapped in the VA system with no options. And it's like...
Because it's a cottage industry. There's a lot of jobs...
That's just bizarre.
That ...tied to an existing delivery system.
That's right.
Whether it's education, whether it's veterans health care, it's built up over time, and in many cases it's proven ineffective, and in the case of the VA, as we've seen tragically, it's had tragic results in some cases. But it's a vested interest. It's a cottage industry. A lot of money's tied up in it, and they fight to keep that status quo. But who gets hurt?
Yeah.
Right? It's the people who are using the
system.
We have tragic results of our public school system right now.
Exactly.
I mean, it's... You know, when you're, you know, the folks on the ground that have to, you know, deal with these kids when they get out of school, this is the end result that everybody is looking at, and we've got to do something. We've got to do something to change it.
Well, again, back to that education, that USA Workforce Tax Credit Act, that's handling both the K-12 years of a child's life, but also dealing with that population who graduated or maybe not graduated, you know, who need those skills, and this enables companies to invest in getting a skilled workforce. And so, again, I appreciate the opportunity you've given me to talk to you and
absolutely.
Talk to your
and we posted HR 51. Yep, we posted
Congress.
It on here for you.
Thank you so much.
People
Aaron
can track
Bill.
That and all go right. See what your member of Congress
Peter,
is doing.
Thanks for being on.
Peter Murphy, Vice President for Policy at the Invest in Education Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back next week. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.